there were a bunch of park riders here. We talked about you today too.
Well, basically there were spaces, so.
Well, that won't be the first time. I just don't want any fussing between you and Heidi. I probably should have remembered this
not
as
on
being,
my part.
Being streamed before I said that. But,
not for me.
Let's pray together. What a blessing, Father, to consider your amazing creation and to see in what is around us your hand, so that we know that you are there. Help us as we consider that tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. We do have a lot of guests. I apologize if mentally you have to play catch up with us just a little bit. I think the class will make sense if you'll hang with us for a little while. I need to ask the regular group to brainstorm with me and tell me what you saw in chapter 5.
The simple life is not so simple.
Simple life is not so simple. Can you expand that just a tad?
Like, he goes on to talk about the single cell of the amoeba and how much information is actually stored in one cell, in the DNA of one cell of that microorganism.
So really important thing, I hope that, you know, over these first couple of classes that you will see, is that the deeper we get into the science, it doesn't get less amazing, complex, and fascinating. It gets more and more and more. The more we learn, the more we are impressed. Thank you. What else did you see in chapter 5? Yes, sir.
Chance is not a cause.
Chance is not a cause, yeah. We'll do some other logic stuff tonight as well. Yes, sir.
The law of uniformity.
Okay.
When you know, obviously we can't go back and view or see the create, you know, the first, whatever it is that you want to say, creation or the non-life to life. So, you know, we got to use the scientific approaches, and part of that is this law of uniformity, this forensic type of analysis of to try to determine what we can view today, and does that match up with?
Does it match with what happened at the beginning? That's exactly right. And oddly enough, at least unbelieving scientists will play both sides of that. We know it's this way because it's always been this way, except for the time when it wasn't this way. So, yeah, it does make for interesting contradictions sometimes. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Only intelligence has been observed creating something that's complex.
Only intelligence has been observed creating something that is complex. So I'm going to jump off the cliff here with Rick's comment. Because that sort of launches us into where I want to start tonight. Thank you for adding that. Are any of you familiar with the movie Contact? Okay, remember that movie? I'm actually going to play you a little clip of it tonight. In the movie, Jodie Foster plays the role of Dr. Ellie Arroway. She works for an organization called, in the movie, works for an organization called SETI. Have any of y'all heard of SETI? What is it?
Search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
The search for extraterrestrial intelligence. She works for them in the movie. You need to know that that is a real organization. People who, for example, listen through radio telescopes for signals coming from space that would serve as evidence that someone's out there. And so they're involved in that great search. In the fictional clip that I'm about to show you, you have the key moment in the movie where she gets a signal that she says has to come from intelligent life. So you don't just get to snooze during this little video clip. I want you looking for what it is that she sees that tells her this cannot be a natural occurrence. There has to be intelligence behind this. So here's the little movie clip that I want you to see. Those aren't in the room, that's in the movie.
Thank you. across the board. What's the frequency?
4.4623 gigahertz. Hydrogen times pi. Told you.
Strong sucker, too. I got it. I'm patched in.
All right, let me hear it.
Could be AWACS out of Kirtland jamming us, but I'm down.
Let's see if Fudd's reading it too. Willie, patch it back and give me the off max. Are we recording?
Never stop.
Thank you, Elmer.
AWACS status is negative.
What about white sands?
And this frequency? No.
Flash of the arcs. How's this plan tonight, guys? Come on.
Alright. LORAD's not tracking any snoops in this vector. Shuttle never's in sleep mode.
Okay, point source confirmed. Whatever it is, it ain't local.
Position?
I checked interferometer somewhere in Lyra, I think.
Vega?
Can't be. It's only 26 light years away.
Hey, what's the peak intensity?
Coming up.
Vega. Watch the time, Sarah. Seagulls, negative results, always.
Got it. We need over 100 Janskis.
Jesus. Pick it up on my...
Restarting. Wait a minute, two numbers. That was a three. The one before it was a two. Base 10 numbers, just start counting now. See how far we can get. One.
Seven.
Those are primes. Two, three, five, seven. Those are all prime numbers. And just look at it. It's a natural phenomenon.
Did you catch that? How did she know that that was not a natural phenomenon? In fact, her language was, there is no way that that is a natural phenomenon. How'd she know?
It's a prime number pattern.
Because math is a universal language.
Yeah, so all they're getting is these pulses, but the pulses are all prime numbers. There was a pattern to them, which was an evidence of what? Well, okay, but why is it evidence of intelligence?
Order. It's a language.
Design. It's a message. They're all prime numbers. What kind of reasoning is she using to get to that conclusion? Do you see it?
Random sounds don't just happen in prime number counts.
Yeah. She's using a design argument. I really want you to see this, because this is really fascinating. For example, this is the argument that we use to prove the existence of God. Every design has a designer, yes, right? The universe is highly complex, has highly complex design. We talked about that last week. Therefore, the universe had a designer. Does that work for you? Is that a rational argument? Listen to what she's saying. Every design has a designer. A signal composed only of prime numbers is evidence of design. Therefore, this signal must have an intelligent designer. In this case, there be aliens out there. The reason I wanted you to see that is because I want you to see that science uses the design argument. In fact, science uses it all the time. So an archaeologist digs into the ground and he finds some clay that's rounded on the edges and smoothed out, and even though it's broken, if you finish the pattern, it could be a pot or a dish. And what does he conclude? Humans lived here. There must have been a civilization of people here at some point, because this isn't random clay. There is design to it, and that assumes intelligence. In fact, I would just go beyond that being a point of science. I think it's just a point of common sense. I mean, I know that I'm blessed to have an incredibly intelligent class sitting in the room with me tonight, and I know that you can distinguish which of those two cloud formations is natural and which one has a designer. How can you tell?
One has a message.
One has a message, right? And so design with a message says intelligence. Do y'all buy that? I mean, it's scientific, but beyond that, it's just common sense. It's reasoning that people use all the time. I want you to hang on to that, because that's really going to play importantly into this next thing that I want us to talk about. Up to now, we have worked on what I think are some of the obstacles for unbelievers. Last week, for example, we started off with, and I hope I don't kick you, because that would just be really awkward. We started off with the beginning, right? What problem do unbelievers have with the beginning?
Where did God come from?
Well, actually, where God came from is our challenge. What problem do unbelievers, atheists, for example, have with the beginning?
Something from nothing.
So how do you get anything at all? Why does anything exist at all? And ultimately, we listened last week to the most famous atheists in the world say the answer to that is, first there was nothing, and out of nothing came something, right? So they have a problem with the very beginning. But this next thing, I think, is a really big deal, because it isn't enough to get something. You've got to account for the existence of life. And so that's the next obstacle that I want us to talk about. Don't forget what we said last week about the cumulative effect. That is really, really important to me. I don't want you to see these things in isolation. I want you to see the problems build one on top of the other. As we move on to other stuff, I want you to remember they started with that something came out of nothing. And I want you to appreciate how absurd that is, what a fairy tale is. There's no evidence for that. That can't be scientifically replicated. Someone just literally made that up. Okay? And so building from there, even if you could somehow figure out nothing, you gotta figure out how the something that came out of nothing came to be alive. Remember the other challenge that the unbeliever has. He's got to come up with some kind of a natural process to explain that. By the way, what's our answer for the beginning of life?
God created.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God made man in his own image. That's how we account for life. We have a story in Genesis where an all-powerful God spoke into existence everything that we see around us. That is a reasonable way. If God exists, the God of the Bible exists, then that is a reasonable way to account for all the living things we see around us. If you reject God, then the alternative is to come up with a natural explanation for where life came from. And I just want to mess around with that idea this afternoon as we move on to this next chapter and this next topic. So let's talk a little bit about where the first living thing began. What does an atheist say? Do you know their story about how we came to have living things? Anybody know?
Primordial soup.
Well, we do start with the soup, okay? I thought that picture was vivid, so I'll throw that up there. That if we get past all of these problems, where the atheist wants us to get to is way, way, way billions of years ago, back on planet Earth, there was a puddle. And somehow in that puddle, all the things needed to make the first simple life form was present and came alive. Can I ask you a question about, well, I mean, Troy, we're getting back to where you started. Can I ask you a question about that life form?
Where'd the pond come from?
Oh, okay, but you understand, that's the cumulative effect, right? The pond itself is a problem. But the chemicals in the pond, that's also a problem.
If you don't have intelligence over chemicals, you can't.
Try
to create life out of chemicals.
So here's my question. Was the first life form simple?
No.
They used to think it was. For example, the father of evolution, the one who popularized it, Charles Darwin, going back not quite a couple hundred years ago, thought those little amoebas were really simple. Why did he think that?
Didn't have the equipment to see in the vertebrae.
Well, yes. They had no idea. It just looked like goop inside that little amoeba. And so to them, that's all that it was. We have made extraordinary scientific advancements since goop in a cell, right? We now have microscopes that allow scientists to look inside the goop, and guess what they discovered? It's not simple at all. You're exactly right. In fact, I just have to tell you, probably for disciples, the discovery that has turned all unbelievers' view of this upside down is the discovery of DNA. I heard someone allude to that a minute ago. Who skipped that one? Let's go to that one. Yeah. Francis Crick and James Watson back in 1953 discovered the DNA molecule. What is DNA? Simple definition?
A coding.
Building blocks of life.
Coding, building blocks of life. The book said DNA contains the chemicals that encode instructions for the building and replicating of human things, or living things, rather. It's the data in your cells that makes you who you are and makes you do what you do, and so unique to every individual that now they use it to track down the bad guys and put them in jail, right? Through their DNA, they know exactly who we are. So I have a second video that I want to show you. Some of you have kids in my Bible class, and so I'm telling you in advance, this is the video I use for my teenagers in Bible class. I want to show it to you for one reason, because that goop in the cell that Darwin didn't know anything about, this tells you what it is and what it's doing. Yes, I know it's kind of a kid video. I'm telling you that in advance. But for those of us who are not scientific, it's helpful. And all I want you to do is to be impressed with the complexity of what's going on in your body as you sit in this room. So I want you to watch this.
Stanley Clearly presents, What is DNA and how does it work? DNA, also known as deoxyribonucleic acid, is a molecule. It's a bunch of atoms stuck together. In the case of DNA, these atoms combine to form the shape of a long, spiraling ladder, sort of like this one here. If you ever studied biology or saw the movie Jurassic Park, you probably heard that DNA acts as a blueprint or a recipe for a living thing. But how? How on earth can a mere molecule act as a blueprint for something as complex and wonderful as a tree, a dog, or a dinosaur?
Best part
to help answer that question, let's first take a quick look at amino acids. Amino acids are tiny little chemicals inside our bodies that are so important, they're often referred to as the building blocks of life. There's about 20 different kinds, each with their own unique shape. The neat thing about them is they can be attached to each other, kind of like Legos, to produce an endless variety of larger particles known as proteins. Amino acids make up proteins. Proteins, along with other chemicals, combine to form living cells. Cells make up tissues. Tissues make up organs. And organs, when they're all put together and functioning, of course, combine to form living creatures like you and me. These proteins that make up our bodies, and keep in mind, there's millions of different kinds of proteins, they each have to be formed in the perfect shape in order to function. If they're the wrong shape, they usually won't work. That's where DNA comes in. DNA does a lot of interesting things, some of which we don't fully understand, but one of its main and most well-understood functions is to tell amino acids how to line up and form themselves into the perfect protein shapes. In theory, if the right proteins are built at the right time and in the right place, everything else, from cells to organs to entire creatures, will come out just fine. This here is a simplified model of DNA.
Watch this.
It shows us that the steps of the ladder are made up of four different kinds of chemicals shown here by different colors and letters. If you look at just one half of the molecule, you can read its chemical sequence or genetic code from top to bottom, sort of like a book. A single strand of DNA is extremely long, millions of letters long. It spends most of its life coiled up like a noodle, living inside the nucleus, or the centerpiece of a cell. Amino acids, however, live outside the nucleus in what's called the cytoplasm. To help DNA interact with the cytoplasm and convert those amino acids into proteins, special chemicals inside the nucleus make partial copies of the DNA code. These partial copies, called RNA, look a lot like DNA, but they're shorter, of course, and they're missing one of their sides. Their small shape and size allows them to fit through tiny pores in the nucleus, out to the cytoplasm, and into the mouth of another particle called a ribosome. Ribosomes are protein-building machines. They read the RNA code three letters at a time, suck amino acids out of their surroundings, and stick them together in a chain according to the RNA code. As the chain grows, it bends, it folds, and it sticks to itself to form a perfectly shaped protein. Every three letters of the RNA code tell the ribosome which of the 20 different kinds of amino acids should be added next. For example, CAA tells the ribosome to grab a glutamine, AGU tells it to grab a serine, and so on. Once a protein is built, it can then go on to do a number of different things, one of which could be to help form a brand new cell. So to answer the original question, what is DNA? DNA is a molecular blueprint for a living thing. How does it work? DNA creates RNA, RNA creates protein, proteins go on to form life. This entire process, as complicated, as sophisticated, as magical as it might seem, is entirely based in chemistry. It can be studied, it can be understood. I'm John Perry.
So tell me what you heard.
Life isn't happenstance.
Sorry?
Life is not happenstance.
Why does what you heard lead you to that conclusion?
Because all the intricacies that take place to create the DNA, that creates the protein, that creates the tissue, that creates the cell, that creates, it just can't just arbitrarily just show up and put stuff together. There's a plan.
So coming back to the issue of first life, let's remember the unbeliever's story. Remember that this is science, as he said at the end. You can look into the cell, you can see all this going on. They figured out how all this works, right? It's a reality. Everyone has to account for that. Genesis does, by the way. Would anybody think this would be a problem for God? No. No, not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible could do something like this. If you reject the notion of God, you're left to natural processes. Chemicals in a puddle. What do you think? Does that strike you as reasonable? What problems do you see with the chemical in a puddle argument?
One thing that stuck out to me in chapter 5 was he talked about how it was supposed to have randomly occurred, but scientists can't even intentionally replicate forming the DNA in a lab by combining chemicals, even after studying.
I'm going to come back to that in just a minute because efforts have been made to replicate what they think the process is. So let me hold off on responding to that. Thank you. What other problems do you see with this argument, chemicals in the pot? Yeah.
I mean, if DNA was first, how did DNA get its programming? Where did that programming come from?
So there's a message. Can we agree on that? There's a message in your DNA. Question, how big is the message?
1,000 encyclopedias.
You read the book, right? Let me throw this up there. This is a quote from the book that Dale is alluding to. The incredible specified complexity of life becomes obvious when one considers the message found in the DNA of a one-celled amoeba, small creature. Staunch Darwinist Richard Dawkins, it is so fun to quote Dawkins, he helps us out all the time. Professor of Zoology at Oxford University admits that the message found in just the cell nucleus of a tiny amoeba is more than all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica combined. And the entire amoeba has more information in its DNA as 1,000 complete sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. If that doesn't make sense, here it is. In other words, if you were to spell out all of the ATCG on the helix there, in the unjustly primitive amoeba, the letters would fill 1,000 complete sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Question. How complex is the message? So, with regard to first life, you're asking exactly the right question. How did a puddle of chemicals form a nucleus with a message that long in it? Maybe it's not important for the message to be exactly right. What do you think? Maybe the DNA could be off by a letter or two, and it wouldn't be a big deal. What do you think? Yeah, I know why you're raising your hand.
Matt Basford is an example of that.
Yeah, do y'all remember the letters lining up right, like the ladder? Remember that? Matt is dying because one of the letters in his DNA is off. Of the millions and millions of bits of data in his cells, one of the letters is wrong. He can tell you which one it is. I'm not that smart. His body is dying. So the DNA has to be right. In fact, I think he said that in the video, that that if they're not lined up correctly, they typically don't function the way that they are supposed to. I think that this presents the atheist with just a huge problem. So once we grant them and work from their something from nothing beginning, we start trying to talk about how life was formed. First of all, let's just be honest, you've got to deal with the issue of creation. Where did all this stuff come from to work with? And then you've got to have the conditions. Go back to what we said last week about the anthropic constants. You have to have perfect conditions on Earth to sustain life, remember? Oxygen level, atmospheric transparency. It's like somebody threw all the switches on planet Earth and turned all the dials just right so we could live here, right? We don't even have life yet, though. Then you got to get the chemicals in the puddle. And not just random chemicals. They got to be the right chemicals. And you can't just dump them in, right? It wasn't like someone said, hey, we just get all the chemicals in there, we'll just dump them in and out will jump a frog, right? What'd you learn from the DNA video? Well, you got to deal with all those chemicals.
Same design.
Yeah, they got to be lined up right. It's a message. Yeah.
And with life, the adaptation seems to answer a lot of questions for people. Like, things can adapt to their environment over time and make changes. but conditions can't really adapt. Like, if you have an ecosystem where it rains and water evaporates, there's nothing living there that can adapt. Like, that's set in place. It's the way it is. The temperature of Earth, the distance from the sun, how fast we're moving around the sun, those are all things that can't really fix themselves if there's a correction that's needed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it comes back to what we said last class about the cumulative effect of this. Someone may come along and say, well, by chance, Earth was in the right spot, right? But it isn't just that it was in the right spot. It's that the atmosphere is just right. And the right blend of oxygen within the atmosphere, and on and on and on you go. And then you get to the tunnel, and you got all these components that are there, and they're all coordinated just right. And you saw what that was like, right? All that DNA has to line up correctly. It just helped me. When the strand breaks, the RNA, and it kind of goes out from the nucleus and it lines up with the other thing that forms the protein. I'm telling you, deeply scientific. that forms the proteins. Who put that machine in there? How does that evolve when all of those things are necessary for a human being, for a living thing, rather, to exist? And then the coding that is present there, that tells it to do the unique things it does, to form the unique things you need for a living thing. And then, who turned the switch on? I mean, guys, if you could put all that together and throw it in a puddle, who made it start working? Who turned the machine on? I don't know. I just don't have enough faith to believe that. Anyone want to weigh in? Let me. I've been kind of lecturing on for a minute. Let me pause and ask y'all to weigh in. Or not.
I got something, Debbie.
Okay, yeah, here first. Yes, sir.
Well, there's a couple of things that might be helpful thing in the mix. The first thing is the video has the amoeba. The simplest cell bacteria has 500,000 more or less of those base pairs in the simplest bacteria, one cell. And a lot of times, bacteria is brought up as the first life,
right?
Possibly. And so that's a number that's almost beyond your comprehension, I think, just thinking about that. And the other thing is, the RNA has to be able to interpret the directions from the DNA. How did that happen? How did this functional piece come into play that could interpret the language to go do something? And then, I don't know if you're going to bring it up, but one other thing is, where's the energy from that causes it to be active and be able to do these kinds of things? And that's another issue. There's a sort of an energy factory in almost every cell that has to be present in order to make this process go.
Yeah.
It's like a, you know, our electrical devices won't work without electricity. Mm-hmm. We don't know without power. Well, that won't work without power either.
Right. It's mind-boggling, the depth of the problem. And guys, we're talking about the simplest living things on Earth. Me and you, way more complicated than that. The problems don't get easier. They get more and more difficult the further we go. Let me go here and then I'm coming around. Yeah.
Just curious, has anyone ever came up with like a probability of...
Yes.
Because I know in times, years gone by, people have done that theme, I think, with creation. But now with like DNA, what we know about DNA, the thousand set of... information, you know, has anyone ever come in and looked at that portion to say the chances of that happening randomly?
Yes. The chances are, okay, you have 150 different types of body cells, and the coding within each one of those cells, you have to have had five numbers to code right, make up that cell in sequence. Then, remember that they have, by chance and probability, they can calculate that. So remember, you hit 1 in a billion at the 11th digit, and the calculation was 340 million digits. That's the probability.
Now you understand the title of the book, right?
Whatever that number is.
Guys, it's a marvel that people struggle with God in light of what the alternative is. I mean, it is just a fairy tale. And listen, what will we know in 100 years that we don't know today? It won't get less complex and less impressive. It'll become more so. Yes, sir.
Well, I was just going to say, like, even us trying to design a computer chip or a car or something like that, you know, we'll go through multiple iterations of it. It won't work. We'll fix something, try again, it won't work. And you go for years trying to design something, and it's still a whole lot simpler than a cell. And so to think that something like that randomly happens when you've got a bunch of bright people trying to put an automobile together or a computer chip together, it boggles the mind why someone accepts that that's required, but that a cell or life can just randomly occur.
So let's talk a little bit about the efforts that have been made to reproduce what they think happened in the puddle, right? Have any of you seen this before? Raise your hand if you've seen that before, or something like that. Okay? What is that?
They're trying to replicate the conditions that supposedly existed at the beginning.
Yeah, this is a sketch of the Uri Miller experiment. And if you took a high school biology class, you've probably seen this drawing before. I actually have one in my office. That's where this sketch came from. I just took a screenshot of it and threw it on a slide. This biology book I got from a teenager I had in Bible class, probably early 2000s, which used to be recent. That's almost 25 years ago. So anyway, this picture is in that biology textbook. And you're exactly right. It was supposed to illustrate, or it was supposed to demonstrate, how the chemicals in the puddle could have formed and created life. And so I think that they put this stuff together in the test tubes and the beakers, and they shot some electricity through it, which was supposed to simulate lightning, and they ended up in the little flask at the bottom with some amino acids, and said, published throughout the world, man has shown how life could naturally come to exist without God. Any problems?
Contaminated.
What's that?
Contaminated samples.
Tell me where you're going with that.
I thought they discredited it because they didn't actually create the amino acids. It was contaminated with other stuff.
Well, okay, so actually, the curious thing is that this experiment has been repudiated for decades and decades. All kinds of issues taken with the nature of the atmosphere that they recreated in the test tube, and finally just dismissed it as not reflecting at all what they think was present at the beginning. I pressed you on contaminated because I actually went back and read a little more of the latest data on this experiment from a couple of years ago, and they found another discovery. The glass in the test tube was actually affecting the outcome of the amino acids that they formed. So the environment that created the devices they used were actually tweaking the outcome in their favor. And then they began to use other devices. They weren't getting what they wanted. So my point about that is, nobody has believed this experiment for a long, long time. And yet, oddly enough, sits in my office a high school textbook with this picture in it. Why? Why, if first of all, from the very beginning, people had questions about this, why put that in the book? But I mean, if it's so clearly been discredited, why is it still in the book?
Gives the answer they want.
Ish.
Mm-hmm. Say something over and over again, people start believing it, whether it's true or not.
Well, why wouldn't you just give a better example?
There is a one.
This is all they have, folks. That's it. And it's still in the textbooks, even though it's been repudiated. And I would just suggest, well, you've got to use that kind of evidence because that's all you got. You have a weak argument. The other thing I'd point out about this is this does not accurately reflect how they believe life began on Earth. What's the difference? Intelligent people working in the finest labs in the country were doing this unsuccessfully, right? I think it says they have a problem with their theory. So where I'm going with all of this is that DNA has just posed an insurmountable problem for the unbeliever's explanation of first life. It's bad enough that we begin with something coming out of nothing, but the story on how you get a living thing, guys, there's not an answer for that, not even close. Well, actually, they do have an answer. I have one more video for you, and it features our favorite player, Richard Dawkins. I use him any chance I get. He's going to explain how life began without God. This is from the movie Expelled. I recommended that to you at the start of class. I really think you'll enjoy watching this. Might recognize Ben Stein from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. This is old movie night in Bible class.
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, how did that happen?
I've told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anyone.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto, perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable, or ultimately explicable, process. He couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design. Just certain types of designers, such as God.
Okay, I just have to point out to you that the guy being interviewed here in the video is the same guy last week who argued for something coming out of nothing. You notice in this video he said, well, it just couldn't jump into existence. So he seems a bit confused about that. What's his theory, by the way?
Asgard
Galactica.
Aliens.
There's a higher power.
Y'all laughed at the wrong time because what he said next was, that is an interesting possibility. He is open to the idea that life came from aliens visiting the planet and seeding life on Earth. This is one of the preeminent evolutionary minds in the world saying E.T. did it. And I do say that mocking. What's wrong with that argument? Yes, ma'am.
Well, then you have to concede that
your argument doesn't make sense, because if you can't explain how we got here intelligently, who intelligently created this extraterrestrial? It just is a sick.
It's all he does is move the problem to a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
No, the most fascinating part of the video is when he says the alien race that we have no evidence for evolved by some evolutionary Darwinian means. He knows how they evolved. It doesn't know that they really exist, which is completely fascinating. What other problems do you see?
Well, he said we don't know how life came to exist here, but then he tried to explain that we knew how life existed or came to exist somewhere else. So he contradicted himself.
It is. By the way, what do we call the genre of movies about aliens?
Science fiction.
Why do we call it science fiction?
Because
we don't have evidence for beings from other planets. It is curious to me that Dawkins does seem to be open to the idea of a designer. Why do you think he's making that argument?
He knows that that's really where the evidence really points.
He's a biologist. He knows about DNA. I'm telling you guys, 1953, just a pivotal moment in this whole conversation. Because once they found out what was going on the inside of a cell, once they realized the coding that is in there, you eliminate natural processes. Guys, when you leave nature, you wanna know what it's like when you leave nature to itself? Don't mow your yard for a month. That's what nature does when left to its own devices. It doesn't code DNA. But why, here's the interesting thing. And Stein points this out in the video. Why is he open to aliens? He calls that an interesting possibility, but God laughable. Why does he do that?
He digs himself out of a hole.
Well, yes. What's that?
It's a different hole.
Why accept aliens and not God? Yeah.
Because you have no responsibility towards aliens.
Unless he's holding a phaser to your head. Right? Unless he's holding a phaser to your head, you are not accountable to an alien. They've got to show up before we have to do what they say. Here's the problem, guys. If God exists, it changes everything. And I have to do what he said. So I hope you'll carry away the fact that, like all of us, scientists, whether they're believers or not, everyone believes in the design argument. In fact, we began with the movie clip from Contact. That was a fictional story. Can I tell you a real story before we're done? In 1967, Jocelyn Bell, also part of SETI, was monitoring the radio telescope, and she noticed a signal from a patch of sky. And the signal had a pattern. It pulsed every 1.3 seconds. Pulsed. Exactly. It's a really complicated message, right? Every second or so, send a pulse. That's what was happening. And the SETI world just blew up. We found an example. It's got to be from intelligence, because it is absolutely steady. They even labeled the pulse, LGM1, which meant little green men one.
It's radiation.
No, until they discovered it was a pulsar.
Oh.
Which naturally pulsed at every 1.3 seconds.
Well, there's a new SETI study that just came out that says that the universe hums constantly.
So here's the point I would make about that. If a message that was all prime numbers in sequence, or a pulse every 1.3 seconds, is enough science to believe intelligence is behind it, what does your code in your DNA tell us? I think people don't want to believe in God. And they do so in spite, they choose that in spite of the evidence to the contrary. Chapter 6, next week. It just gets worse.
Did you have that article, though?